So just to give a little bit more intro about who I am also a graduate of Mississippi State. I came through during a time when this building was not even here. And so it's pretty cool to see the progression of the university. I left here in 2007 and went on to Georgia Tech to get my PhD in electrical and computer engineering. So I finished undergrad here in computer engineering. I also serve on the Dean's Advisory Council to the College of Engineering. I also am on the advisory board for the School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. So definitely keep close ties and roots to Mississippi State. I worked with Eric on several initiatives, several boards, and helping students here as much as I can. And so I love tennis. I like playing the piano. I was this close to majoring in music. I was this close, but you can do both. You can be both technical and creative. People try to pigeonhole you into one or the other, but you can do both. And so I had the opportunity to also study abroad when I was at Mississippi State. I did co-op. I did several internships. I was in Seoul, South Korea. I think that's at the top there, and also in France, right there. And now I'm in Atlanta. So I go back and forth between Atlanta and Jackson, which is my hometown, Jackson, Mississippi. So yeah, I'll tell you a little bit more about some of the other things on this slide, but just want to give you an intro of who I am. So I like to always show this picture. This is my first computer, all right? And I know you all are young. You probably don't remember they made computers like this, and the speakers were on the side, and like the sound was in your face. You just don't make them like that anymore. I'm sorry y'all missed out on that. But the thing about it was, the internet was so slow. There was this thing called dial-up, all right? And I had to wait for my grandmother to get off the phone for me to get on the internet to download one song, and it would take all day to download this one song. And if she had to get back on the phone, I had to stop the download, and you would hope it would start back, but sometimes it wouldn't, and you had to start all the way over. All right? And so that was the age of computing that I came up in. We also had these things called floppy disks. You could probably save one Word file on that disk and it would run out of space. So if you had a whole thesis paper, you probably had multiple floppy disks. And so one of the things here that I want to point out is that the difference between age of computing then and the age of computing now are two major things. All right? It's the difference in how much data that we store on a regular basis. That includes our photos, that includes our music, any type of documents, and also includes our ability to be able to transport that data at a much faster pace. All right, so two things, data storage and a transfer of that data. That's what catapulted the whole AI movement. If you realize, you think back, if you do research, you can go back 10, 15, almost 20 years. Some of the AI technologies that we're using today were already being used by the government. They were already being used in the military. But what was the difference? Someone came up with an interface and said, you know what? I want to be able to make this where anybody can access this technology and not just people who know about technology. And that was the difference. And also the advancement of data storage in the cloud, and also the advancement of being able to move a lot quicker along our data lines. So be thankful where you are. All right, so I like to show this picture because Thanksgiving is my favorite meal. All right, anybody like Thanksgiving? Yeah, so yeah, we throw down in my house. So yeah, grandma cooks, everybody. And so I like showing this because I had a mentor. Actually, she was Dr. Donna Reese. She was the chair. She was several things here in the College of Engineering at the time when I was here. She basically was my mentor, helped me get on the right track, was the reason I attribute a lot of my success at Mississippi State to her. And she told me, she said, Nashley, you can have it all, but just not all at the same time. So when I eat Thanksgiving, I'll start early in the morning. I start eating turkey. I start eating some of the green beans. By the time lunch hits, I'm getting another plate. By the time the evening hits, I'm getting desserts. And by the time the end of Thanksgiving Day, before we start playing Uno with my cousins, I would have eaten everything on the meal plate. And I want you to approach life like that. If you think about it, I've had experiences in startup companies. I've worked in corporate. I've gotten a PhD and worked in academia. I've also mentored and worked in the nonprofit space and literally have touched almost everything I possibly can in the tech industry. And you can do it too. But just remember, pace yourself. You can do it, just not all at the same time. I also want to point out another thing. The tech ecosystem is very broad. Whether you're a coder, whether you're someone who trains AI models, whether you are someone on the business side, there is a place for you. You may be an investor. Maybe you have generational wealth and you're interested in pouring money into startups that you consider to be very profitable in the long term. Wherever it is, find your place in the tech ecosystem. You can do several things, even in the nonprofit space. And I'll tell you a little bit about my nonprofit Bean Path towards the end of this talk. But just want to make sure everybody knows that you don't have to be technical to be in the tech ecosystem. Okay, can anybody name all these parts? Who thinks they got half of them at least? Okay, we got, you must work in. Okay. Okay, there you go. All right. Well, at one point I could name all of these when I worked at a startup company called PartPick. We had a young lady, her name was Jewel Burke Solomon. Shout out to Jewel. She was the founder of this company called PartPick in Atlanta. So I was a struggling grad student working on my PhD at the time when we met. And I said, oh, your idea is pretty cool. She said, yeah, I'm a customer service rep. I work at a parts company called McMaster Car. And people would call in and say, hey, I need this part, but I don't know what it's called. And this was 2012, okay? So we didn't have all this extra technology that we had now. And she said, you know what? Can you just describe the part? And they'll say, yeah, it's kind of big. It's the size of my hand. It's like black. And it's silver on one side. Can you help me find it? And so, of course not. Basically, parts companies spent tens of millions of dollars each year returning wrong parts back and forth to these people. So then she had the idea, just take a picture and send it to me, because she got tired of getting, you know, cursed out on the phone. And so she got the picture. She said, wait a minute. Can we create technology to automatically recognize the part and just cut out the middleman altogether, so we can get them the right part and even have them buy it automatically over the app? And that's what she did. So she came to me because she wasn't technical. She was actually a Howard University grad, and she did not have the technical background, but she had the subject matter expertise in parts and customer service in parts. And that a lot of times people think that just because I'm not technical or I have this idea, it doesn't mean that you can't be the one to solve that problem for not just you, but everybody else that's just like you, and finding a market for that and scaling your business. So usually they say, you know, you just got to find a pain point. And oftentimes the things that you deal with every day, the pain points you deal with every day, are something that somebody else is dealing with too. I talk to a lot of students. We do a lot of hackathons on the side with elementary kids, middle school kids, high school kids, and they happen to hate the cafeteria lunch. So one of them actually came up with an idea for a business to have Uber Eats delivered. Now, of course, Uber Eats was already in existence, but they were able to get their principals to approve Uber Eats to being delivered at their high school. So that's just an example. You never know what might happen. So we're actually pretty successful with that company, PartPick. We had a chance to present at the White House with President Obama during White House Demo Day during his administration. Anybody heard of a conference called South by Southwest? South by Southwest is a huge conference with tech, music, film, and all these things in Austin, Texas. I actually just came back from Austin, Texas at a conference called Afrotech and spoke there as well just yesterday. But huge conference, especially if you're in the startup space, a good place to go meet investors. We actually pitched in their accelerator competition, and we won that competition. That was our first $200,000 investment. We also had a chance to win a pitch competition called Rise of the Rest. Rise of the Rest was started by a guy named Steve Case. Steve Case was the co-founder of AOL, which was one of the first internet browsers. And so he actually featured us in his book, and he decided there's innovation going on all around the country, not just in Silicon Valley, not just in New York City, but in the rest of the country too, hence the name Rise of the Rest. So it's still going on today. And there are several others that we looked into: TechCrunch Disrupt, Small Empires with Alexis Ohanian, he's Serena Williams' husband now, and also several others. Accenture had one. So I say this to say, a lot of our early stage funding, are y'all familiar with like the different rounds of funding for startups? So first, with a startup, if unless you're just gonna fund your own project, which often doesn't happen, even if you have the money, most people don't do that. Most people make money off of other people's money. That's a very important lesson I had to learn as well. So at the very beginning stage, it's called the friends and family round. So that's when you're raising money. You're going to mom, you're going to uncle, you're going to, your close friends. You say, "Hey, I got this idea. Do you believe in me? If not, get out of my way. Let me find somebody else. But if you do, and you got the money, this is going to be a big thing. And you're going to get a bigger payoff than the people that invest later on in the company." And so you basically get some money. Usually it's a smaller amount, maybe 50K or so, 10K, it depends. And then you move on to the next round, which is what we call the seed round. So the seed round is the next step. This helps you get to your MVP, or minimum viable product. Once you do that, and sometimes they call it the beta phase or even the alpha phase if it's a tech product. Once you have that, then you can start generating some money, getting some pilot customers, and then you want to do the next phase around round of funding, which is usually after you've gotten several customers. They call it the Series A, and that's followed by a Series B and a Series C, et cetera, if you even get that far, because not most companies don't. So those people you see on Shark Tank, they're more likely Series A. Some of them may be later seed rounds as well, but they want to see that you've generated some money and that you actually have customers that will buy a product. And they want to invest in that. VCs as well, they're using for later stages. All right, so keep that in mind. So this start pitch competition, winning pitch competitions was an easy way to get some of that seed round money so that we could take our product to the next level. So this was me actually presenting at a conference in Boston about the technology part pick in 20, it was May of 2016. And so I was very much so introvert. Didn't really want to go to the conference, but I knew I was a CTO of the company. I basically was able to build the first prototype for Jewel, and she took that and she raised the money. Our first round of seed round was $1.5 million. So we were able to build that. I was actually working in New York City at the time, so I came back to Atlanta when she raised the money and became their CTO full time. I had all these guys working under me. It was great. It was great. And so this was me presenting 2016. It's about 2 years in. I came down those steps and a guy from Amazon was in the audience. He said, "Man, we really like what you were talking about up there. Can we exchange information?" And so we did. And 3 months later, we sold our company to Amazon for multi-millions of dollars. So after that, we got acquired by Amazon. Now, what does that mean? Anybody know what acquisition means? All right, so acquisition basically means another company buys your company. That means they now own all the intellectual property. They now own all of your code. They do a very thorough vetting process called due diligence, where they get a lot of lawyers involved. They make sure you're not using any third-party software that doesn't belong to you. They really dig in deep. And there are companies that specialize in helping law firms dig in deep into what they call M&A or mergers and acquisitions. Okay, so our company was acquired. Does that mean everybody joined Amazon? No. Sometimes when your company's getting acquired, they don't want everybody. They might just want some people. They definitely want the core business and the core product, but they don't necessarily bring everybody into the next company. So not everybody got an offer. Majority of us did, and at that point, I decided to joined Amazon. I was given an offer and I became an applied scientist manager at Amazon at that point. And that was actually 7 years ago on yesterday. So that was my 7 year work anniversary of getting our company acquired. So to give you an idea, once we got acquired, we now have to do what we call port the code. So that means take everything from our platforms that we had at the time and move it over to AWS. Move it over to everything that Amazon had on their framework and their background. And this is definitely a learning curve when you're going from being a startup to now working at a big monolithic company like Amazon. So you can imagine there's a lot of culture changes there. And if you ever have a company, you thought about a company, you will at some point have to think about your company culture. Like, what type of company are you going to be? Are you going to let people take off from Christmas to New Year's? Are you going to let them have unlimited vacation time? It's actually very common in startups. That's what we did as well. Are you going to also think about how you hold people accountable in your company? Otherwise, they're just going to, do whatever they want to do. So this was the product once we launched it on the Amazon shopping app. So we had a team of UX designers, AI scientists. I was managing the whole tech team. We allowed you to take a picture of the part and the penny. We used the penny as a size reference, so we could get the real world measurements from that. So we know this is a self-drilling screw, and now we ask the user to select the hairstyle and then to select the drive type. So once they do that, they hit see search results, and the measurements we show them at the top, and then that first screw in the list is the actual screw that's in that picture. So that was the value added that we created for all those parts you saw earlier and hundreds more. We also have a patent in this. So patents, that's a whole another conversation we can get into on what you can do, provisional patents, how to protect yourself while you're doing your pitch competitions, et cetera. But I think the main thing to notice here is that there was so much work that went into this. Because if you think about it, you have it's not just training an AI model. You got to think about the interface. Because if your model, if your technology is, I don't care how great it is, if people can't use it, if it isn't user friendly, it is literally useless. So that's why we need other people on our teams. When we're creating our teams for our companies, you may be the tech expert. You may wear the CTO hat. But you need somebody to wear the CEO hat because you can't focus. I mean, you can try, but you're going to significantly limit how fast you can go. And we recommend when investors see somebody that's a one-man show or a one-woman show, it stirs them away because they know that that's not sustainable. So you want to make sure you get a well-balanced team, find people that have strengths where you have areas of improvement, and that's what keeps you going. All right, I think, let's see, how are we doing on time? Okay, all right, cool. All right, so I always like to do this little demonstration of AI and how to think about AI in terms of the simplicity of it. But I know a lot of you say that you don't train models, so I want to give you a clear picture on what AI is. So most people think, okay, you have the world, you give the system an input, some magic happens in a black box, and then you return an output. But it's a lot happening in that black box. But I would say don't be so concerned about what's happening in that black box, because nowadays you can pretty much train a model without even writing code. They call them no-code solutions. You can even design your whole interface without even any code. You can do your whole wireframing without any code with technologies like softwares like Adobe XD and Figma. And that gives your developer a really clear picture of what it is you're trying to develop. But anyway, getting back to the AI, let's do a real simple example. All right, so let's say that we're trying to create an AI model, which remember, AI is not a human. It only does what we tell it to do. Let's say that the AI cannot think for itself, it cannot look for itself, it cannot talk for itself. We have to figure out, okay, what is important to order to identify the difference between the things that we're trying to determine with an AI model. So let's say we're trying to determine the difference between a cat and a dog. So let's say we pick two parameters. We're going to say length and weight. Seems pretty simple enough to help us determine the difference between the two. So what we can do is we can now plot that on a graph. So we can put length on the x-axis, and we can put weight on the y-axis. If you're not a math person, just stay with me. Just stay with me. All right. So let's say you got a dog, right? And let's say we walk about a mile down the street, and we're going to plot the length versus the weight for the first seven or so dogs that we see. So we're going to put that in blue dots. So we may get something like this. Now, let's say we do the same thing for cats. We're going to walk down the same street, the same time of day, or maybe right after, and we're going to walk the same distance and find about seven or so cats and plot them with green dots. All right, so now you can start to see, based on our sample size of walking down the street, there's a line that clearly distinguishes the difference between the two. We've just trained an AI model. It really is as simple as that. I remember y equals mx plus b. I know you're very smart. You're in Mississippi State. So what this AI model says is anything above this line equation is probably a dog. Anything below this line is probably a cat. And that's really as simple as it is. Now, what happens when it's not so simple? What if it looked something like that? So what do? Math scholars. We just get more lines. We get more parameters. We get more than just weight and length because we need something more to identify the difference between the two. And so it gets so hectic to where we got so many parameters that we just write it a totally different way. We call this the neural network. So you get some inputs, a bunch of math is happening on the inside, and then you're getting some output. This is how we train models with tools like PyTorch and TensorFlow and several other systems that are out there. But those are the two most common ones. So basically, when you're training your neural network or deep network, you get some inputs, you get some outputs. Because there's so many parameters and dimensions, we can't visualize that on a 2D piece of paper. So just to give you an example, if we have a model that is to determine if a skin lesion is cancerous or not, I want you all to tell me what how many parameters you think this model uses. Seven? Okay. Anybody else? How many? A lot. It is a lot. Anybody else? So, as it turns out, it's 100 million parameters. That's a lot of math. So we can't do that by hand. Hence, the need for what we call cloud computing. Very fast computational power that you don't have to buy and put in your living room because it would take up the entire living room. So now you have computers in the cloud that are able to process things. And now with generative AI, y'all heard of ChatGPT? I know you're using ChatGPT. You don't have to raise your hand. Okay, I know you're using it. With generative AI and all these other tools, they're into the trillions of parameters. So remember what I told you before? Data storage and being able to transfer that data a lot quicker. The two game changers for AI. But where does that limitation stop? Because we have all these data centers and all these computers in the cloud that are moving data is traveling through the air as we speak. So much data at a very fast rate. Where's the limitation? So now we're getting into climate issues and sustainability issues. Because these things are going to take so much energy to process, something's going to give. Our grid can only handle so much. So that's something for you all to figure out because I'm getting to almost 10 years of retirement. All right, so let's transition a little bit. Just want to make sure you all understand the difference between machine learning and just regular software. There's so many more concerns. We can only do what we have data to do. Garbage in, garbage out, right? You need to constantly test AI systems. And also, you can always depend on new releases performing better than the previous release. So if you're familiar with ChatGPT, it's based on one or two main large language models called GPT 3.5 and GPT 4. When they upgrade to GPT 4, if you were building a product at your startup using ChatGPT and they change the model on you without you, because they don't have to ask you to change the model, it's their product, right? It could totally change how your software and your product works for your customer. So that's why we have to constantly test, especially when you're using third party anything. So just so you know, by 2025, the AI technology industry will reach 204 billion. This is very much so on the path that we're on, and it touches every industry, it touches every application. And if it doesn't, just wait, it will. If I were to place bets on top startup companies in the next 5 years, I would say healthcare and transportation, because those are the two most untapped. Maybe even throw in sports and entertainment in there too. So who's going to be training all this technology and who's going to be leading it and who's going to do it responsibly because there's a lot of issues. So I mentioned that there are so many different, this is just AWS customers alone, everybody from the NFL to Mastercard to Salesforce, the Seattle Seahawks, everyone's using AI cloud computing. And I highly recommend you check it out if you have a startup company and you find a place for it in whatever it is that you're building. However, we want to make sure that we're doing it and we're building it responsibly. There's a lot of concerns with AI in the world. People who are not technologists, they actually fear this technology. They fear it will take over their jobs. They fear it will take their privacy. They fear it will violate their civil rights. And I've had the opportunity to speak on behalf of AI companies on Capitol Hill in front of Congress. It's not a fun place to be because everybody's afraid and nobody gives, of course, Amazon the benefit of the doubt. So you just want to make sure whatever you're building with your technology, you're doing what you can to make sure you use it responsibly so you don't get headlines like this, like Amazon did back in 2019. So I'm gonna get into how you build technology a little bit more responsibly, and then I'll conclude with the work that I'm doing in Jackson to kind of help include others and expand the access of this technology, and then we'll take questions. But we want to make sure we find a balance. Yes, the generative AI is cool. There's some really great software out there, but there's emerging risk and challenges. There's even more than we can even keep up with. Actually, if you were paying attention, Biden just released a statement on, I think it was Monday, on how to create secure, safe, and trustworthy AI technology. And why this is significant? Because companies like fintech companies and healthcare companies will eventually be mandated to uphold certain standards and compliances that are coming down from Washington, D.C. Whereas before, there was no enforcement, no regulations whatsoever when it came to AI. And so another thing to keep in mind too, those who are maybe have a technical background, you're interested in policy, you're interested in government work, there's a lot of people in DC making decisions about technology they know nothing about because their people like us aren't there to help them and guide them. And so that's another area to get into. I definitely recommend it. All right, so when I say responsible AI, what am I talking about? I'm talking about fairness, our systems having equal performance across different populations, different demographics, and even subgroups of those demographics. If you think about voice technologies, us having a southern accent, me being a black female in the South, how do technologies work for me versus my counterparts? If you also think about face technology for lighter skin, darker skin, men versus women, and even intersections of those, you have to evaluate these things. You can't just assume unless you test. In terms of explainability, if you're denied for a loan, you're going to want to know why, right? Most of the companies out there cannot tell you why. They have an algorithm they use, they put your metrics in, and it comes out with a result, and they just take it for face value. So that's a problem. Robustness. Can I unlock your phone with just a picture of your face instead of having your actual face? Do you intentionally test your technology for these adversarial attacks? People that are going to intentionally try to hack into your system and use it in an improper way. In terms of privacy and security, that's even more important when it comes to any type of human data or personal identifiable information. We call it PII. Definitely something to keep in mind. Governance, how do you ensure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing? If you think about Amazon, we have a lot of customer data with the Amazon retail side, a lot of credit card information, people that use that and they're taking that data. So someone has to label the data before you put it into your AI model. Are they actually using that and only keeping it where it should be, or are they taking it and doing other things with it? And how are you as a company enforcing this governance across your employees? And then lastly, but not least, transparency. As a big company like Amazon or even a smaller startup company, just be truthful about where your technology performs well and where it doesn't. Nothing is guaranteed to work across the board for everybody, 100% every time. AI models are built on probabilities. That's the nature of how they're trained. So I also want to talk about a couple of issues here. There's something called equity and equality. We like to think of equality as, okay, you give everybody something, the same amount, and hope that they will be able to achieve the same task. That's not always the case. With equity, you can see that some people need a little bit more than others, depending on different things. The same can be applied to AI technologies. Sometimes when you're training models, you may have disparity in one particular demographic, You may need a little bit of extra training data for that particular person when you're training your model or that particular data. When we did the example with the cats and dogs, maybe in New York, they're smaller dogs. Maybe in Jackson, Mississippi, the cats are bigger. I don't know. But unless you test, unless you diversify, you won't know. You won't know if you need more data from one than the other. So that's another important topic. And then also what we call intersectional fairness. So you may have two groups, let's just say married versus single, where you have equal distribution of positives and negatives. This could be anything from acceptance rate into college admissions. This could be acceptance for a loan and denials for a loan. So it looks pretty simple, right? You have seven pluses and nine minuses for each group. So you would say, okay, this is pretty fair. I'm good. I can stop here. That's not always the case. If you break it down even more and add another parameter like employed versus unemployed, you can quickly start to see where your disparities are. For example, married, unemployed have way more declines than pluses. All right, so a couple of other risks, especially with generative AI. Sometimes it returns things that just aren't true. We call them hallucinations. Also, there could be some toxic, we call it toxicity and safety. It can return possibly discriminatory language towards certain groups. You want to make sure you have guardrails in place for this. Also, it can sometimes violate intellectual property. You can create a quote that makes it look like it's yours, but it actually came from somebody else. That's a problem. We all know that. And then also, in terms of data privacy, sometimes it can leak information that it never should have had access to begin with. And right now, there's a huge legal dispute with Congress and other lawyers that just because information is on the internet, does that mean you can use it? So definitely something to think about, something we haven't really thought about before now. All right, so here's some books I recommend if you're interested in this topic and you want to get into this area a little bit more. I guarantee you it's not going anywhere. It's definitely here to stay. And I like to talk about it, one, because it's my job at Amazon, that's what I do. I work on responsible AI. I actually helped create that team at Amazon and my principal there. And also, it's definitely, again, with the increase of AI, and I'm sure you can leverage it for your businesses, you're going to have to be aware of some of these things and will be mandated to use it. So just real quick, lessons learned. Testing for unseen areas amongst intersectionalities are key. Also, take into account your confidence scores and error bars. This basically, I say everything is based on probability. When your AI model releases a result, there's a probability associated with it, and you use that however you want to use it. Representation matters, that's always the case. Transportation, reproducibility, and education can promote change. That's what we're doing today. Confidence in your product's fairness requires fairness testing. Cannot assume unless you test. You just can't. Fairness has a role throughout the entire product life cycle. Just because you release a product, your MVP, doesn't mean that it's good forever. Sometimes you can release a product and it is not biased at that time, but as time progresses and environments change, it can become biased over time. So you always have to have a almost a iterative feedback loop, checking to make sure that those things aren't happening. Always make sure you keep in mind your use cases too, and the context in which you're dealing with your environment, your end users. Make sure that you have an understanding of how the product is affecting them as well. Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up with telling you a little bit more about BeanPath. BeanPath is a nonprofit I started when we sold the company to Amazon. I started going back home in Jackson and started doing some of the things I always said I was gonna do and wanted to do, like start a nonprofit to help people. This was just one of our tech help desks we used to do in one of the libraries in 2018. We just recently celebrated 5 years of continuing with BeanPath and doing things like tech classes and things like that. During COVID, the libraries closed. So we actually had to go and find a space. And so I said, well, maybe I can purchase something. So I went downtown Jackson, a lot of dilapidated roads and areas that needed to be revitalized. This is actually downtown. And I saw some of these buildings here, and I basically bought them. So I now have 21 acres of land and 8 buildings in downtown Jackson, and we're building a whole tech district. Everything from housing to retail to tech and lab spaces. We have 2 buildings. It's just a rendering of what that will look like, the completed product. But we have 2 buildings that we've opened so far. So one of them is our maker space. I think you all have maker spaces here. So it's basically a place where you can go and make everything, use 3D printers, develop prototypes. You can also, we teach a lot of classes from UX design and AI. We have a robotics club, adult robotics club as well. And so people can now just get access to this, whereas they didn't have that access before. The second building we just did a skate party in. And so this is the Bean Barn. And so this is what it will look like, the finished product. But we basically have this huge event space, 17,000 square feet. It's literally a barn in the middle of the city. It's the coolest thing. This is really, this is actually where we did our 5-year anniversary at as well this past week. And we're doing even more. So definitely happy to keep you all updated on some of that. Check out Bean Path and the work that we're doing. And we can tell you more about that. So real quick takeaways, start somewhere with your company. You don't have to be an expert in everything. You probably will never be an expert in everything. I can attest to that myself. You can be both creative and technical, despite what people say. Leverage the ecosystem. Don't try to do it all on your own. Find values in the differences, because you don't want to be in business with someone who thinks the exact same way that you do, has the exact same background that you have. That's of no value to you. Keep fairness and inclusion in mind. Give back and sow seeds because someone helped you get here. And so think about that and think about how you expand that and just keep paying it forward. And this one's for me. I always put this for myself to remind myself. Self-care is essential. So I know you're in college, and I remember those days, never going to sleep, going to parties and going straight to class type thing. But you got to get some self-care in there. You know, whatever it is, figure out what that is for you. All right. And that concludes the talk. Thank you so much. I think we're doing a Q&A. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Okay, go ahead. And then we'll come here. So I always say at the startup, I was CTO, so there was no glass ceiling. There was no corporate America. There was no, I felt like Shuri on Black Panther. Like I could just do whatever I wanted to do and have my own space. But when you're at a company, you know, you're subject to whatever those companies' goals are. The company can literally, and they we literally this year changed, had reorgs 3 times. We had layoffs. 20,000 people were laid off. So at any given time, you're never safe. But when you have your own company, you call the shots, you do what you want to do. And so, but the benefit of that is it's not as stable, it's not as steady. And so that's often a challenge for some people who have like a family, if you have kids, if you're taking care of someone, you need steady income. That can be a challenge. So I encourage you to do that while you're young, if you're thinking about startups. But also, the more you learn in life, actually, older people who have lived life experiences, you're probably more likely to succeed as a startup in your older years too. But that shouldn't stop you from trying. When we sold our company, we had been in operation about 2 years, and that's like winning the Super Bowl your rookie year, which likelihood of that happening is slim. But again, doesn't mean you shouldn't try. You have more resources now than I ever had growing up. So and going through all of this, I didn't even know what a startup was. I was working for a startup, so that tells you right there. So, but now you got all these resources like what Eric Hill has here and Entrepreneurship Center. So definitely leverage those resources as much as possible. But that was pretty much the difference between the two. All right, here and then we'll go right behind you. Yeah, it's right now is the time because oh man, there's so many. I went to a talk yesterday and they were doing their own plots with AI. I forgot what the name of that tool was called, but there's now so many because people jumped on the generative AI train and more large models are being trained now. So you actually don't have to worry so much about the technical. This is the time for people who aren't technical to get into AI, because of all the tools. And I think if you understand, I always say if you understand how the tools work, you can use them to your advantage. So I would focus on educating yourself on what's available and what you can use like right now. And then try to think about, anticipate where this is going in the future. Because nothing, tech moves so fast. Like say three different reorgs in 1 year. Just because something's hot right now, a month later it cannot be. So just try to make sure you anticipate change. That's one thing that's constant when it comes to AI. So I think I would say it really just depends on the industry. I would say Python is always pretty much every single tech company uses Python. Every big tech company. Some of the more enterprise softwares like at fintech companies like Capital One, et cetera, they may use Java or C Sharp still or some of those other tools. And of course, if you're into like front end stuff, JavaScript is really cool. You can do a lot with it without having to dig in deep with all the different libraries like React and Angular and those things. So they often teach kids either Python or JavaScript with one of those libraries just to get them started. And those have pretty much sustained in the last 10 plus years. I can't wait to leave. No, I'm just kidding. but no, it's funny because I almost left, and they just kind of reel you back in sometimes. They say, okay, well, wait a minute before you leave. Let's discuss some things. You get a little extra here and there. But I think it's pros and cons because I do get the stability. I'm actually very very valued at Amazon at this point in time in my career. Now it didn't start out like that. But I worked my way up, and so even if I left, like they would let me come back. I think also though, there's a lot that you can't do working at a company because any type of IP, whenever you work at a large company like that, they make you sign a non-compete, which is very broad and it's very broad intentionally, so that they can take any intellectual property that you're doing while you're working for that company. So you have to kind of keep things very separate. Until you leave and then you launch whatever the things you are doing. There's some ways around that too, like advising other companies or passing on your vision or your idea. Maybe you funding it, you just getting a team to do it and build it. But there are a lot of people doing both. There's a lot of people working companies and they're figuring out how to keep their 9 to 5 as well. So. Once was there technology available for what we were doing or just in general? So this funny thing, bless you, funny thing, we actually had a better product before we started moving it over to Amazon, because the you think about it, the Amazon app has been around, well, even before we were acquired, and it's not much you can change there. There's only so much you can do. And so we had a way better product. We actually incorporated so many more features when we were just building it ourselves that really could have probably taken on a whole new market eventually. But we had to kind of scale back some things once we got it onto that platform. And we launched that back in 2018. And it ended up getting taken out, I think, in 2019. But they still have the camera search feature in the Amazon app. So that's some of our technology as well. But you're not allowed to put the penny in there because the phones have actually advanced to where phones can now measure the distances between your the surface and the phone now. But that wasn't the case at the time. So I just think that we had a lot more freedom to innovate and be creative when we were not at Amazon. And then we were significantly limited, but at least that got the product out into the hands of millions of people. Whereas we couldn't do that alone, at least not at the time. We would have stayed and carried the product on. We could probably have gotten there, probably could have taken it public, But the issue is, and this is something I want you to realize, when you have a startup company very early, try to keep your equity as close as you can. Only give away equity to people that you see value in, maybe employees that the company would not be successful if, unless they were at that company, advisors, and there's certain ways to allocate equity. But at a certain point, we got to that place where if we did another round of funding, like another seed, we were actually going to do another seed round. And that was going to end up taking away majority of the company anyway. And we were so early stage that we didn't have the revenues to sustain us to get past that without giving away the majority of the company. And so, hence, that's why we sold. We actually all are doing much better now. Jewel started her own VC fund called Collab Capital. We also have, I don't know if y'all ever heard of Slutty Vegan. It's like a food truck with burgers, Impossible Burgers in Atlanta. It's a big thing anyway. You can look it up. But he's president of Slutty Vegan now, and they've scaled to a $25 million company. Now they have locations all over the Southeast. Of course, I'm doing the real estate project, so we're all in a much better place. It was a tough decision. It was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. We battled it out in the room together. But that's the decision we made, and we're proud of it. What made us do our own technology? Oh yeah. Well, I saw a lot of people who majored in music who didn't have a job at the time. And I love music. I mean, I went to a performing arts high school, and so I love music. I had scholarships. I was gonna be a classical pianist, and I still do that. And so the thing is, I knew that like no one could take music away from me, regardless of what I major in. So that's always gonna be there. But I knew I had no idea what computer engineering was, and I wanted to learn more. And so that's what ultimately helped me decide. And then I actually came to Mississippi State in the 8th grade for a camp for a Society of Women Engineers. And that was the first time I knew what engineering was. And it just blew my mind. And so I always had that in the back of my mind, and that's what I wanted to do. And again, I knew music wasn't going anywhere. Like I have a band in Atlanta. Like we recorded an album. Like we still do all that type of stuff too. And it's just kind of like a side thing though. Yeah. Okay.
So, whenever you merge with Amazon, is it called like either concern or was it a free
It was not a smooth merger. It was not. So it would never be a smooth merger. You always, okay, they say the good deals, people always walk away with a little bit of unhappiness, a little bit of what they didn't want, a little bit of what they did want. That's a good deal. We negotiated a few things. One, we did not want to move to Seattle. We were staying in Atlanta. That was a non-negotiable. Two, we wanted to make sure majority of our team had a job, or at least a nice severance package. So we got that. And then also, we wanted to make sure that they actually followed through on us launching our product. Unfortunately, it still got reorged and taken out. But so now there's a few companies I've seen that they still attempt to do the part thing, but not the way we were doing it. So it's still literally an open problem that has not been solved, and it still can be solved. But I just can't do it because we sold it. We sold the IP and everything. So that, kind of, you don't like that. And Amazon is a big, I mean, I work there, but they show no mercy. Like they have, you cannot fight them legally. So they know exactly how much money you have. They know exactly what will make you break. And that's what they negotiated their price point at. And so I think in hindsight, I think we were undervalued. I know we're undervalued, so that was also not cool. And then when we got there, we got stock, right? We probably had more stock than some of the people we were working with on our other team. And I don't think they really liked us because of that. And so there was a lot of hostile, environment, just in the work environment. Like I literally had one foot out the door. So when you sell a company, they don't give you all your money up front. They want to make sure that they vet the technology. So they give you a vesting schedule. So you don't get all your stock. You get some payout up front, but they pretty much put you on a schedule where you get a little bit every 6 months or so. And for us, it was a 3-year vesting schedule. And so for the stakeholders, those who had actual equity. And so a lot of us were, 2 weeks notice leading up to that 3 year point, we were already gonna leave. And I think for me, I ended up staying because I switched teams and went to work on the responsible AI stuff, which was a much better position for me. But most people already left. They call it the golden handcuffs. So you can't go anywhere unless you want to just put leave some money on the table, which I am not that type of person. All right. Oh, we got one. Okay.
My dad worked in sales, and he always would talk about how some people were very malicious, and if they have to cut your legs out from underneath you in order to get to the top, they absolutely would. Is that kind of mindset big in like what you've seen in your work experience, where you've seen people do very malicious things to whoever it'll take to get ahead, or whatever they see is a better off kind of,
Yeah.
place to be? Do you see that a lot?
So that's
What
off.
does that look like?
Yeah, I mean that's often how it goes in corporate America. That's like the definition almost. So it's like you got to be bullish to work your way up. And I actually don't. I mean, if that's what you got to do, hopefully you work in a company that doesn't. I think that significantly changed during COVID and George Floyd and us working outside the office. It's hard to like go off on somebody over Zoom. So it's like it kind of softened a little bit. But now that we're going back in the office, who knows? And that has a lot to do with leadership too. Like again, it all goes back to that company culture. Like, do you want a culture where everybody's stressed all the time? Everybody hates each other on the team. You never do any team building events. Nobody really likes each other. They really don't want to work with each other. And that really doesn't lead to productivity, right? So why do we perpetuate this? And so I think it helps to have diversity in leadership. It helps to have mentors, and it helps to think about, how these decisions that they're making are impacting people. So right now, we just so for example, we just got a mandate to be back in the office 3 days a week. Amazon did. This is after, being off since COVID, being out of the office, and there was a lot of pushback because there's a lot of nuances to this, right? So for example, I am based in the Atlanta office. But I don't actually work with anybody in the Atlanta office. All of my teams are Seattle, DC, Palo Alto, New York. And so just last week, they released another mandate saying if you're not in the office 3 days a week, it's basically what they call a voluntary termination. So they're going to fire you. So that's what we're dealing with. And it can happen at the snap of a finger if the CEO makes that decision. That's what it's going to be. So that's just corporate America. A lot of people, that's why a lot of people don't want to be in there. They want to do their own thing, startups, entrepreneurs. I get it, but it is a place for some people and just how you navigate it. All right. Thank you all so much.